We're very happy that Ry Cooter is our guest today on the World Cafe. Some of you know his work going all the way back to when he used to teach Keith Richards how to play slide guitar when they were working on Let It Bleed and, of course, a series of solo albums for Warner Brothers in the 1970s. He's probably been best known lately for his work with the Buena Vista Social Club and a lot of production work. He's been doing also movie soundtrack work. He did have a solo album last year called Chavez Ravine, which was a history of the music of Los Angeles in the 1950s, along with a discussion about the politics of what went on when a community in Chavez Ravine was razed to make way for public housing. Well, this new album called My Name is Buddy has a political slant to it as well. You can follow along with a story Ry Cooter has written in the booklet with wonderful illustrations from Vincent Valdez. But I think we need Ry to explain some of these characters. For instance, who is Buddy? Buddy's a cat, but where did Buddy come from?
Buddy the Red Cat lived up in Vancouver, Canada. Now, you know, You can figure the probability here. A friend of mine, Fat Dog of Berkeley, mm-hmm. who's an old friend who runs a guitar store, happened to be up in Vancouver area vacationing. And he sees this photograph printed on paper, stapled to a telephone pole, of Leadbelly sitting, a famous picture of Leadbelly, one we all know well, with his 12-string. But photoshopped over his face is this cat's face, a photograph, mind you. And it says, Buddy... It's a death notice, Buddy, -2005. So he takes this thing off the phone pole, puts it in an envelope, mailed it to me, thinking I'd be interested. He noticed it because he's a guitar man, and he thought the Leadbelly thing was interesting and strange. I called up the place, Red Cat Records in Vancouver. I convinced him it was me, and I was interested in Buddy, and who was he, and where'd they get him from? What's the story there? And it turns out he's their mascot. He lived in the store. People came in to see him over time. Red-colored, big tomcat, with this sort of frown, kind of perplexed, worried look. At that time, while I was working on Chavez Ravine, and I had been thinking about our disappearing American working man or woman and the labor scene and the unions and solidarity and unity and all of these things that seem to be retreating or slipping away, that we have a country here built by these people, you know. But I didn't know what to do about it. I thought I'd like to make some musical comment on this, but how would I add to this sort of storehouse of union songs and old-time working songs and stuff like I used to like to do when I was younger. You know, I didn't see it. Then I saw Buddy, and I thought, that's the handle. It's Buddy the Red Cat, the fable of the sort of, you know, uneducated farm boy who goes out and meets up with the labor message and learns the labor, the way of life. I mean, we all understand fables and animals thinking and how simple they are and how we can say these things, you know.
And there's an arc to this story. Various, you know, he meets up with Lefty Mouse, various right. things happen labor-wise. Mm-hmm. But it moves through time in a really interesting way as well. But the real feel is kind of 30s depression, which if people, as you mentioned, know your career, you know, your first few albums with Do Re Mi and How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live, songs from that era, that's always fascinated you musically. Mm-hmm. Do you have an understanding why?
Well, of course, these songs are the music of the people they were written by. What was a musician in those days? You know, we have this strange post-Hank Williams warped, I think, image of what a musician is. In those days, it was somebody who could play an instrument, and your uncle or your aunt or the fella next door in these little rural towns, let's just say, and Blind Alfred Reed of West Virginia Mountains, you know, being a perfect example. And one day he probably got up out of bed and said, "How can a poor man stand such times and live?" Ultimately, he starved to death. It's an actual historical fact. But he must have, this phrase must have come to him. And he sat down with his fiddle. He was a fiddle player. "How can a poor man stand such times and live?" And then maybe soon after that, somebody came along with a portable recording machine, which was invented, fortunately, or this never would have happened. Because once these things started being turned into records, which were sold back to the local people who understood what that song was about, they discovered a business, and they invented the recording industry in America, you might say. I mean, distinct from classical music and Caruso and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the amazing thing is we could actually listen to this this fella, Blind Alfred Reed, say those things. But what was he? He was just a fellow who lived down the road. And the story is one of hard times. It's not of good times. I mean, do you think a billionaire sits down and writes a song about being a rich man or making a killing on the market? They don't. They wouldn't do it. They don't need to, you know. They got other interests. They got other irons in the fire. But your average Joe plays a banjo or guitar or fiddle, does it for some inner, because of some liking for the sound or the feeling of doing it, and then maybe somebody might pay them $5 or $10 to go play at the dance. And maybe they do that, and somebody else says, well, come 20 miles further, and there's another dance you can play. And pretty soon they're traveling, and pretty soon somebody finds out. I mean, how many times have you heard this story?
Well, one of the other things you did was you went as close to the source, and as far as musicians are concerned, to work with you in a lot of ways. And I'm talking about people like Mike Seeger, who plays many things, of course, banjo, but harmonica, many things all over this. And Roland White, people may not know Roland. They probably know his brother Clarence, because he became kind of a rock star. But Roland White is an incredible bluegrass mandolin player. You got him on here, and I'd just like to talk. If you talk a little bit about how you set things up musically for yourself, and one of the things you might want to focus on is going to Pete Seeger's house to record the Jay Egger song.
Well, of course, the folks on this record are friends of mine, old friends. I met Roland when the White family first came out to L.A. in the 60s. I was in junior high school, Clarence, Eric, and Roland. I've been knowing him a mighty long time. I had lessons with Mike when I was in high school, and he had the New Lost City Ramblers, you know, so these are like the people who know this stuff, friends as well. And the other thought I have there is, when you listen to these old records, might be Charlie Poole or some little gospel quartet, you're usually listening to people who are either family or their neighbors, you know. I've heard that story a million times. It was my brother on guitar, or it was my neighbor on harmonica or something. They grow up together. Well, they have the same mindset. Therefore, the music has this kind of an organic sound, a unity. Well, how are we going to do that now? We're also diasporic, you know, and spread around and separated by miles and telephone lines and computers and this and that, and all which tends to prevent this from happening. But of course, you get together in the studio with your old pals, you can do it, I think. And we're the old timers now. That's official. I looked around the room and on the buddy sessions, and I noticed we're all white-haired cats now. We're all like on up in the years, but also on up in the experience. And you know, we combine knowledge. Patty Maloney, Mike Van Dyke Parks, you got some knowledge in the room. But you can't fly Pete out to Los Angeles, because he's not gonna travel there. So you go to see him. You go to the mountain to see him. So me and Brother Mike went up there to Beacon, hung out for a day, and recorded the J. Edgar the Pig song, and sat around and talked, and I should say Pete talked. And we had our chicken soup lunch that Toshi made, and it's really good. And just had a great time. And there's a story, a day of stories, and a day of Pete's theories about the universe and how much the combined weight of the human race is. it was interesting. Some of it I follow, some of it I can't, but it's fantastic. So these are the experiences for me that make these projects, you know, so interesting and memorable, you know.
Well, let's listen to what happened in that room when you and Pete and Mike got together. I guess they're both playing banjos?
Yeah, twin banjos, which is nice. So you've got the long neck down low, and you got Mike on his one of his weird old banjos tuned up a little higher, I think. It's a beautiful sound. Brothers at Work, you know.
A song about a pig you may recognize. It's J. Edgar.
Down on the farm we had a pig. J. Edgar was his name. We'd eat up all our victuals and start back up again. Just like the vacuum cleaners, they sail down in the lane. Well, that's how J. Edgar Hoover got his name. Now Mama baked a cherry pie and set it out to cool, so we'd have something good to eat when we got home from school. J. Edgar climbed up on the porch and ate up all that pie. When we got home that morning, we heard our mama cry. J. Edgar, J. Edgar, just look what you've done. You ate up the cherry pie that was for everyone. We made it through the dusters and the hoppers too. But God help us, J. Edgar, 'cause nothing's safe from you.
J. Edgar, one of the tunes from My Name Is Buddy, the album, the allegory, the story, complete with incredible illustrations, and I guess, Ry, you wrote the kind of story that goes with the booklet, right?
Yeah, Buddy, I wanted Buddy to sit there and tell you a bit of what actually happened, because the tunes may appear to be kind of lighthearted and jolly, you know, like music can be, and we understand this about some of this stuff, that the events behind the tunes are actually quite serious and dire at times, you know. Buddy gets into some terrible trouble here. But he learns to cope with things and recognize and understand, and the world's a tough place, you know, I like the stories. Of course, the drawings are fantastic, you know. You got to admit, J. Edgar's a bad looking, you know, he's a rough looking pig there.
No doubt about it. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this music and how it fits into our culture and that. But that seems to me, as you talk about being the white hairs in the room, that seems to be an older person's view on things. I'm curious about you as a kid and how this music grabbed you to begin with. I mean, you're talking about being 14 and getting lessons from Mike Seeger. How did this grab you to begin with in Santa Monica?
Well, when I was around four or five years old, and there was a man who was a friend of my parents who gave me this first guitar that I had. Leo Brager's name was. He was a concert violinist that played with the L.A. Philharmonic, had been blacklisted and had to take work as a camp counselor. And a similar story, you know, we've all heard these kind of stories. But over at their house, that family, they had three things. They had the musical instruments and the guitar that he actually gave me, which I'd never seen before until he handed it to me. I said, "What is this?" "Well, it's a guitar," he goes. "He strums and the thing vibrates," and you knew that was interesting. The next thing he had was they had Pogo books in the house. Mm-hmm. Pogo Possum, the cartoon character invented by Walt Kelly, which seemed to me to be the ideal antidote to living in Santa Monica, which is an incredibly dull place. I like Santa Monica, mind you now, but it really is just a grid of streets and little lawns, and we live in these corny duplex houses that I hated. It was just flat, and it was just didn't seem to speak to me at all, but these Pogo books did. The way that the animals reflected real people and social problems at the time, mostly having to do with McCarthy. Funny and not so funny at the same time. And the third thing was the Folkways albums of the Dust Bowl songs of Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston to a certain extent, and those farm security photographs of country people, you know, running from dust. And it just, and in their old cars and things, and it just looked like that's it to me. Who are these people? Where is this happening? It didn't look anything like Santa Monica, see. So I guess I was curious. And of course, the music and the photographs create this kind of sensation of being in another place. You listen to the music, you're taken there. You can go there in your mind, and I still do it. I mean, I don't go so many places, but music is sure a nice magic carpet ride for you. You know, it'll take you out there, and I really like that feeling then, of course, learning to play the guitar was great. I mean, you could do it for yourself, and I stayed interested in it. It's a lucky thing.
And we're happy you did. Ry Cooter is our guest. We're talking about My Name is Buddy, which is this new album. I want to play some other things because there's so many different things stylistically on here. One of them is, boy, when these guys start singing, I just get goosebumps. When Terry Evans and Bobby King do this thing called Sundown Town. Tell the story about how this fits in and maybe a little bit about that.
Well, one day I woke up, I was working on Buddy, and I turned on NPR, as a matter of fact. And here was this man talking about a book that he'd written called Sundown Towns. He'd researched this and done the work, and it was all about the whites-only sort of smaller communities dotted throughout the country where it was legal to say, black man, don't let the sun set on you in this town. That people could work there, but they couldn't stay there. They couldn't buy property there. They couldn't live there. And he went on about this, and I listened for 10 minutes, and I ran into the other room, grabbed the guitar, Sundown Town, Sundown. Don't let them catch you, buddy, when the sun goes down. It's perfect. I thought, well, this is terrific, because this will introduce for me a third character. So we've got Buddy the Cat, then we got Lefty Mouse, the Bolshevik labor organizer. Now we're gonna meet the Reverend Tom Toad, who's blind. He's lost his, you might say, inner sight, his spiritual confidence. Because the Klan, this is all based in fact, the Klan came in, the reborn Klan came in and ran all the people off the land. It was a land grab. It was just that it was hardly any different from Chavez Ravine, only they wore white sheets instead of clipboards and, you know, and building site charts. But that's the idea. So the character of the Reverend Toad is this preacher Toad, representing a kind of a black country preacher style of speaking and thinking, you might say, who simply says, help me, you know, I'm blind now, no place to go. And they take him with him. So he's sort of a mystic character in this thing. And in the end, he regains some of his inner sight back, I think. Because hope is reborn at the end of the record to a certain extent. And then you have three characters and you have three distinct characters. And I like three. I mean, three is a nice number to work with, you know. Gives you some dialogue.
This is the story. This is the Sundown Town.
My eyes have seen the beauty of a land bright and fair. My soul looked out and wondered, can we make the journey there? But I've lost my sight, and I have to be led. Well, I mean to work for justice till I'm dead gone. Sundown Town, Sundown Town.
That's on Ry's new album. We're talking with Ry Cooter, and that is Sundown Town, Terry Evans and Bobby King from My Name is Buddy. I read something really interesting, Ry, but you ended up mixing this on iTunes?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we take great care to record a certain way. If it's in Pro Tools, as people might know. Nowadays, we don't have tape. We don't have the analog machines to receive this, but Pro Tools is this digital setup, you know, and you can, it's handy, it's a good tool. But we have a lot in front. We have old ribbon microphones, we have old radio compressors and all these things to try to record, and we sit together close, you know, we're near one another, we're singing live, so that the thing sounds right, so that it sounds like it's happening. But then you're stuck with this problem, and that is, at the end, you have to do something we call mastering, where the tunes are leveled out and so that it'll play so that you won't have to run to your player and tune it up or turn it down or add bass or you know, fiddle with it. You don't want to do that. So they want a clean streaming masters, as it's called, that you can send to the manufacturing people, and they manufacture your CD, and it sounds good, for heaven's sake. But every time we did this, it was harsh. It had left the buddy realm, and it was starting to turn into something else, and I didn't like it. And then I noticed that my copy that I made in the iTunes program on my computer at home had this soft, almost analog 33 1/3 long playing record sound, whereas the engineers, when they would master this, the thing sounded jagged to me and toothy, you know, and it irritated me, made my teeth hurt. And Buddy started to sound aggressive and pointed, and I didn't like it. So I said, either I put Buddy in the drawer and we forget it, or it's going to sound like this. And then everybody's telling me, oh no, that's iTunes, that's an algorithm in there. They called user preference. You can't master that way. Oh, you can't do that. So I said, well, by God, I'm going to do it. So we made a copy, balanced it within the iTunes program against all the best advice, and sent it to the manufacturer, you know, all leveled out and done properly. And they sent it back. It sounded perfect. Suit yourself, you know. Why else would I do this? You know, Buddy's not the kind of thing I'm going to say, I need the money. So I have to go with the best advice. You know, it's not like that. I need this thing to sound good. If it doesn't sound right, then it isn't right. See, it's all an illusion, but a nice one. So the iTunes thing, you know, was helpful.
Right, Cooter is our guest, and I wanted to play one more as we head out of here, which is Three Chords and the Truth, which sums up a lot of the political things and a lot of these people you've been talking about on here. Mm-hmm. And just a great piece of music. Anything we should know about it?
Well, Three Chords and the Truth is a great statement. They asked Harlan Howard, the country songwriter, to define a country song, and he said simply Three Chords and the Truth, which is one of my favorite sayings. And in this case, the application here is that we're looking at three people who sang, and their message came through their singing, and that was Joe Hill, the original Wobbly, Paul Robeson, the opera singer, and Pete, Uncle Pete Seeger. Now, Joe Hill was actually executed by a firing squad in Salt Lake City, Utah, for singing. Seems extreme, but it's a fact. You know, his famous tune, Pie in the Sky, and all these things. And he was basically very straightforward about the message. You know, this is who you're up against. This is what you have to do to fight for your rights. And so they took him out and shot him. Okay, Three Chords and the Truth. That's what he was singing. You know, simple songs. Paul Robeson was hamstrung, and then J. Edgar Hoover drew a noose around his neck and prevented him from working and traveling and took his passport away and wrecked his life. Three Chords and the Truth. Pete Seeger, they tried the same trick on him, J. Edgar, but Pete had some kind of resilience, plus he had an incredible bravery. All these guys did, but Pete had some way of, he triumphed. Or as Frank Wilkinson says, you know, he outlived the bastards. You could also look at it that way. But that's three people. We ought to take a look at what they did and how they believed in the word. And they sung the word, and Pete could do this in a room of five people or 500 people, get them to put their differences aside and think as one. It's very useful. Well, I talked to Pete on New Year's Day. I called him up, say, hi, Happy New Year, and how you doing? And he says, music's still a good bridge. You don't get a how are you from Pete. You get music's still an important bridge. Keep doing it. So we keep trying. And I think it is true. These old Union songs meant a lot to the movement at the time. They can mean a lot to us now. Singing is good. You know, like Buddy says, if you sing and sing out for the next person, you're doing something that the boss cats and the power elites and the fascists and the clowns in Washington don't do. They don't write songs, and they don't sing. So that's my little notion.
I'm gonna tell you a story.
That's Three Chords and the Truth. Ry Cooter, My Name is Buddy is the journey you will take. And thanks so much for the new album. Thanks for talking with us, Ry.
Well, thanks for having me here.